This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:08 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day.
Number 5.
Kicking things off with today being International Dance Day.
I wasn't dancing. I was coughing or something. I don't know what it was.
You were being very expressive with your hands.
I was, yes. I grew up on Fred Astaire. Well, actually, he's like my grandfather's father's generation. Twilight up. Okay. So in case you didn't know, International Dance Day, also known as World Dance Day, is celebrated every year on the 29th of April. It pays tribute to the art of dancing as well as aims to empower the dance community to show their work to a wider audience.
So very briefly, the idea of today originated from the International Theatre Institute in collaboration with UNESCO Performing Arts. And they wanted, understandably, and as you can tell from the name, to promote various forms of dance globally. The reason it's marked on April 29th is because it's also the birthday of Jean-Georges Nouvet, who created modern ballet.
Yeah, from the depths of the 18th century, so 17-something, right? So every year, the International Theatre Institute invites a distinguished choreographer or dancer to give a special message. This year, they had renowned Argentine-British ballet dancer give the message. She highlighted the importance of preserving and honouring the history of dance and the contributions of masters, artists and choreographers.
So we also reached out to Professor Dr. Joseph Gonzalez, choreographer and artistic director of Ask Dance Company, for his hopes on this day.
For International Dance Day, my hope is that everyone, able-bodied and differently abled as well, are able to enjoy and experience dance and reap the full benefits of having dance as part of their lives. For professional dancers in Malaysia especially, I hope there are greater opportunities for them to showcase their talent to various audiences and obtain the kind of support, financial, emotional, that their talent demands, and that dance becomes accessible to everyone. Happy International Dance Day, everybody.
That was Professor Dr. Joseph Gonzalez, choreographer and artistic director of Ask Dance Company, getting in touch with us on today, which happens to be International or World Dance Day. Let us know, has dance played an important role in your life? Is it something that you enjoy watching or experiencing? You can call 7733 2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 4.
And now in a transition that I think makes quite clear that Top 5 at 5 is always going to be an odd show, a buffet of stories. Male victims of love scams are underreporting these crimes.
We've talked about scams quite a bit on the show, but more recently, there's been an uptick in love scams. Lynn, a report that has revealed that although victims of this particular scam are mainly women, male victims are also on the rise. Now, this data was shared by Dato' Sri Ramli Mohammad Yusof, who is Bukit Aman's Commercial Crime Investigation Department Director.
So if we look at what the numbers tell us, in 2022, there were 794 victims. And out of that number, 149 were male. The number has continued to increase in 2023, with the Investigation Department Director sharing that last year, out of the 935 cases that were reported, 196 were male.
Now, so the police said they believe there are more victims, but cases go unreported as male victims are unwilling to come forward, citing embarrassment as one of the reasons for that.
So you might already know, I think a lot of people have become very familiar with the term. Love scams involve syndicates that target individuals online through social media and online dating sites. And I think the thing about this is that in some ways, what's being talked about is something that I think a lot of us would instinctively guess at, that in general, for victims of love scams, it's hard to come forward. It's a very personal thing. Typically, what has happened has a real emotional impact, right? Because you've lost money, but you've also lost, in some cases, what you thought was a relationship, sometimes a very long relationship. And so I think in general, there's a lot of embarrassment attached to that. But it's also quite easy for people to be dismissive of love scams as the purview of, to use a harsh term that I've heard people describe, the purview of spinsters, you know, just lonely women who,
and
you know,
men.
No, but the concept of it, what people traditionally think of as the classic victim of a love scam, is this idea of a woman, right, who's trying to get married because there are all these outmoded ideas of what it means to be in a relationship. And I think all of that means that if you're a male victim of a love scam, it's even harder to come forward because the embarrassment is somewhat compounded.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's this embarrassment about the loss of money. There's a loss of that relationship you thought you had. But maybe also a loss in your own sense of your ability to discern what is real and not real,
right?
That must be, probably the greatest shock to the system, that somehow you missed it. You missed all the red flags and you went ahead and trusted somebody and parted with your money. But first of all, your own capacity to tell very basic things, right? Who's to be trusted or not? So we reached out to industrial psychologist Victor Goh, who shared his opinion why male victims are more hesitant to come forward.
Yeah, so generally I agree. Men do tend to find it a bit more difficult to report their experience with love scams. And I think for two main reasons. Number one, it's really societal expectations, right? So normally we assume that when there's an issue and there's a problem, whether you are victimized, etc., it's easier to find pity and sympathy if you're a woman, if you're a female, compared to finding sympathy or empathy when you're a male. So that, in a sense, the imbalance between understanding for empathy for victims actually leads to men underreporting a lot of things, whether they are victim of love scams, whether they're victim of abuse even. Men tend to underreport. Now, that's a very, very common trend, actually, unfortunately.
Victor also talked about the measures we can take to support and encourage male victims to report.
First and foremost, it's really tackling the mindset, the negative culture that is prevalent in society towards men not being able to open up, right? So it's really tackling that mindset, making it aware, making the public aware that, you know, everybody can fall victim to it. There is no such thing as one particular gender group is more susceptible to it, is more acceptable to it. The mindset has to be every victim is the same. We trust every victim. We respect every single victim. It doesn't matter whether or not you're a man or you're a woman. So that's one thing. I think another thing that we can do to provide a platform for male victims to come forward is really similar to what we did with women. If you remember a few years back in the Me Too movement, what gave the platform for a lot of women to come forward to speak about their abuse, speak about their experiences, was the fact that there was safety in numbers. So I think one very simple way to encourage men to come forward is by making it more common, making it more acceptable, making it more easy to see, right, that there are quite a large number of males who also fall victim to love scams or to anything else. If you can give a platform for men to come forward, whether anonymously or non-anonymously, to say, look, these are a community of support, these are all the men who have been victimized as well, that will encourage more and more men to say, hey, you know what, if all these men can come forward, then maybe I can share my own story as well.
That was industrial psychologist Victor Goh talking about essentially a revelation from Bukit Aman that love scams, or victims of love scams, male victims, are on the rise, and yet it may continue to be underreported as well. If you have thoughts you'd like to share, you can call 7733 2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be continuing our countdown to the biggest story of the day on Top 5 at 5 after this, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
It's 5:17 and this is Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So we started things off with story 5 being International Dance Day, which is today. Story 4, the underreporting of love scam cases involving men.
Number 3.
Which brings us to Penang's water tariff hike causing a public outcry.
Yeah, the thing is, you might not want to pay more. I think that's only true of all of us, whether you're in Penang or not. But what if it's for everyone's good? This is the problem that I think Penang is facing now. Since raising prices, Penang's Water Supply Corporation, otherwise known as APP, has gotten around 300 complaints from consumers since the new rates kicked in about 2 months ago on the 1st of February. Penang Chief Minister Chow Kon Yao revealed this in a response to criticisms from the opposition party Gerakan.
So that February 1st hike was the first review of the rate in nearly three decades, with the new rate starting at 62 cents for the first 20 cubic metres. Now, that is admittedly a 182% increase from the previous rate of 22 cents. And while that is a big jump, obviously, PBAPP's CEO, K. Padmanathan, clarified that the average domestic water rate in Penang remains second lowest in the country after Terengganu. And to justify the hike, he said the increased revenue would be used to fund infrastructure projects to improve the state's water resilience, which, as we know, for Penang actually has been an ongoing issue now.
Yeah, absolutely. They've had water cuts. They have all kinds of problems with water. Now, complaints have also come in about the bi-monthly billing system. To that, K. Padmanathan said that it's been implemented since the 1990s, and actually lower costs compared to monthly billing, with consumers saving up to 10 to 15 ringgit because of this system. He added that the average individual spends only 20 cent per day on water.
Can we talk about that? Because I think the issue of that you raised earlier, Sharad, about paying more, this notion of it, when we get down to how much that comes out to, if I told anybody, I think, hey, do you know that for having running water in your house that you can use, you know, for being able to access that freely, you're paying 20 cents a day. I think it's quite striking in that most of us are probably under the impression, especially when you talk about rate hikes, that it's more.
Yeah, I think one of the things...
I think it's a psychological thing.
Absolutely. I think what it is people don't like to... They don't like change, right? So if this... the rates haven't changed in Penang for 30 years.
Yes.
And, you know, people think that's okay. And then when suddenly there's a hike, and I blame the people who didn't raise prices gradually over time, now doing it one go does seem to be a shock. But when you look at it, right, people complain about strange things. So when it was pointed out that the bi-monthly billing actually saves
you money.
People complain. When you think about how precious water is as a resource, and that we're only paying 20 cents a day for it. It does seem that we haven't gotten our heads around how important water is, and what I think we were told that in fact it's important for the reinvestment in the infrastructure, right? So I think that is where it's at, and it's going to be a problem for Selangor or two.
So we reached out to Professor Datuk Dr. Chan Ngai Wing, Honorary Professor of Environmental Management at USM, to ask, you know, really this question that we're going back and forth on. Are we paying too little for water? And what are the consequences of paying so little?
In my opinion, I think Penang has always enjoyed very, very cheap water tariffs. It used to be the cheapest in the whole country. Now, with the tariff increase, we are actually the second lowest at 86 cents per cubic meter. The lowest is Terengganu. But if you compare to the whole of Malaysia, the national average is about 1 ringgit per cubic meter. This is also still very cheap in the region compared to our neighbor, say Singapore. Singapore is paying Singapore dollars 2.74 per cubic meter. That works out to be about nearly 10 ringgit. If you compare Singapore to Penang, it's even more, maybe 15 times Singaporeans are paying compared to Penang. So definitely, I think our tariffs are too low, and this is not encouraging any water saving or conservation at all. People are not paying attention to saving water.
That was Professor Dr. Chan Ngai Wing, Honorary Professor of Environmental Management at USM. So we've asked you this before, but I think it's worth asking again. Do you think basically that even though we enjoy relatively low water rates around the country, maybe not as low as Penang, but nonetheless, right? Are we paying too little for water? Does it make us wasteful? Call 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number two.
An ongoing story in some ways, this one. big moves in Sarawak.
Yeah, in pursuit of greater autonomy, Deputy Prime Minister Dato' Sri Fadilah Yusof suggested that Sarawak allow business folk to migrate there as they are, if they're willing to deposit 2 million ringgit in a state-owned bank or purchase property valued no less than 1.5 million ringgit.
So comparisons have been made on this to other spaces, right, that have done similar things. Sarawak's Premier Tan Sri Abang Johari Oping welcomed the suggestion, saying that the state has overtaken Johor in economic development and hopes to soon overtake Selangor. He added that a similar policy, and there it is being implemented in Singapore to generate more income. But he made it very clear that the offer is only restricted to granting permanent resident status, not citizenship of Sarawak.
Interesting. Does anybody remember that Sarawak has citizenship? That's something that I think is worth talking about. Anyway, so we reached out to Dr. James Jin, Professor of Asian Studies at the University of Tasmania, to understand the rationale behind the suggestion.
So the rationale for this 2 million Sarawak PR status is that Abang Jo is working on the assumption that there are many West Malaysian businessmen who would like to penetrate the Sarawak market, and it will be easier if they are a resident of Sarawak. He also believes that there are some people uncomfortable with the political trend in Peninsular Malaysia, and they might want to move over to Sarawak as well, where, you know, everyone understands it's a much more multicultural, multi-religious environment. To be fair to him, this 2 million getting a PRD is not a new idea. It's been practiced in many other places as well, that you get a residency status if you make a significant business investment. For me personally, I think the 2 million is actually a bit on the low side. 2 million ringgit is only about $500,000. I would have thought he would be putting at least 4 million ringgit. So 2 million is actually on the low side. Most businessmen can easily access 4 or 5 million.
That was Dr. James Chin, Professor of Asian Studies at the University of Tasmania. And on top of that, earlier we said big moves in Sarawak. There is also a separate conversation happening about Sarawakian lawmakers aiming to remove the word state from the Sarawak state legislature as the assembly is called. So it, going from that to a region in Malaysia, so moving from state to region.
Yeah, so I think the wilayah thing is already there in the mix, but the Dewan Negeri, right,
Negeri,
is
yeah.
what they want. They just want to drop, so it would be like Dewan Undangan Sarawak rather than Negeri Sarawak or something like that. I think this is very interesting because it really is part of, I think, a general sense of where how Sarawak sees itself, and the way it sort of has ambitions that go beyond sort of Malaysian ambitions. And I think that's fascinating.
So if you've got thoughts on the story, you know the numbers. You can call 7733-2900, send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Top 5 at 5. Stay tuned after the 5:30 news for our biggest story of the day, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
It is 5:37 and you are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sherrod, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So to recap what we have so far, Story 5, International Dance Day. Story 4, the underreporting of male victims who have experienced love scams. Story 3, Penang water tariff hike. Story 2, Sarawak pulling in business folks to migrate there, provided they can put up that 2 million ringgit or purchase a house for, I think, 1.5 million. So that's where it's at. If you would like to weigh in on any thoughts or questions, you can call 7733-2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number one.
Kuala Kubu Baru and the by-elections. I don't mean to sound so resigned. It's just anytime there is an election of any sort, you know, the stories just keep coming. And this time, it has to do with the fact that nomination day was on Saturday, which, as you know, in the case of protocol means that campaigning has officially begun, which is why you'll be seeing all sorts of chatter about educational qualifications, and what else has there been, Sharad?
Yeah, the educational qualifications is
a big one. It's been funny, yeah. Actually.
And then there's all these people who used to be in this party now campaigning against their former party, and then there any number of sort of people reading the tea leaves saying, oh, PAS was not at the opening, maybe they're not supporting Perikatan, and somebody from Bersatu saying that's not true. So there's going to be a lot of this, for some people, really banal discussions about political maneuvers. But ultimately, what I think is going to happen is there's going to be enough noise for voters to somehow make a decision. They're going to have to make a decision based on both information and noise and vote on the 11th of May.
So part of this noise really is just the nature of campaigning. And I think there has been an increasing kind of awareness about what is considered, what does it mean to have a free and fair election, right? It's one thing to say, oh, no fraud, no this, no that. But in terms of conduct from parties as they head out on the campaign trail, what is and is not okay? Because for a very long time, I would say, I think we all have a slightly warped idea of what is acceptable. And that's been shaped by political practice of the past. But now everyone's looking around and seeing, okay, well, what are they doing? Is that cool? You know, are you giving anything away? Are you announcing things? And so part and parcel of that is last Friday, Berse questioning the Selangor government's decision to host an open house in Kuala Kubu Baru during election time, with their steering committee saying that such an event could in fact be in conflict with many provisions within the Election Offences Act 1954. Of course, Selangor Menteri Besar, Dato' Sri Amiruddin Syari, has refuted these claims, saying that there were no campaign elements and that it was open to all of Selangor, basically, even though it took place in KKB.
Yeah, but, you know, that, I think, you know, sort of disregards the optics of it and the question of why the location and whether politicians should actually go the extra mile not to do these things, right? You know,
not to do questionable things.
Yes, not to do things that look like you're transgressing election laws, not to do things, especially when you're in government, to look like you're using government machinery to aid your own side. So to be careful and to be, you know, extra... it's very strange, right? You're asking politicians in some ways, Lynn, to act in their against their own interests. Their own interest is to use everything at their behest to, make their side wing. But they should actually be much more restrained, I think.
Yes. Although, again, my position is always that in some ways it's also us. It's also what people, the electorate, expect from politicians and political parties in relation to this. Because, like you said, they will act in their own best interest, or they shouldn't, but they typically do. Part of it, though, is what the public expects, that you think around elections that there will be goodies, that there is a sort of kind of unwritten but certainly big expectation that, yeah, this is just how it is. So there are a number of things to talk about here, and joining us to do that is Faizal Aziz, the chairperson of Berse. Faizal, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Berse recently spoke against the Selangor government's decision to hold an open house in Kuala Kubu Baru last week, saying it could be in conflict with provisions in the Election Offences Act 1954. Talk to us about those provisions and how gatherings like this could be in violation of them.
Okay, first of all, basically, we welcome the changes in terms of the flow of the program, if we monitor closely. Especially when the event, for example, for Giving Duit Raya was cancelled. And at the same time, we were made to understand that there was no candidates presence during the program. But anyhow, we could emphasize, or we should emphasize that since it is stated in Election Officers Act, especially in Section 8, organizing a feast, for example, or having jamuan kenduri, it is during the campaign period, after... penamaan calon, it is still regarded as an offence under Election Offences Act. So, there are many politicians be sarcastic to Berse when we always criticise this, you know, organising fees. Yes, of course, if you want to get the people, you have to provide some food and so on. So that's the reason why Berse always advocate for the amendment of Election Officers Act, because yes, there are certain provisions that could be perceived as archaic laws or archaic provisions. So let us have a dialogue. Let us have something on the table so that we can do something better without violating any laws or provisions in the law.
Faisal, I want to follow up on something that Lynn mentioned, is how Malaysian voters themselves might be expecting this, and that they put pressure, maybe directly or indirectly, on politicians or political parties to behave in this way, to have the jamuan, to have, you know, little gifts, maybe not bribing them with angpao and cash, but you know, so what? How do we look at the way the public has also shaped the practices that happen around election time?
Yes, this is a problem, because I think it could be said that it become political culture when there is a by-election in a certain place of time, in certain venues or certain places. So people or the voters expected something new in terms of announcement, major projects from the ruling government. So there should be change, because of course it was there since maybe after independence. So at least now, we should be optimistic. Even though, yes, you could buy, the idea of voters to vote for you in favor of you if minister come to your constituencies and announce certain projects. But I think moving forward, people look at the bigger picture, at the more constructive or inclusive policies that benefit to all Malaysians, not just to constituents in by elections.
So Selangor MB Datuk Sri Amiruddin Syari has refuted the claim, saying, look, there were no campaign elements, the event is open to Selangorians as a whole. Do you see this as enough clarification?
Yeah, actually, as I said before, giving or serving food and giving out money, for example, during the election period, regarded as an offences under the Section 8 of Section 8 and Section 10 of Election Officers Act. So I think we should make it clear, if you want to do something, in terms of the campaign, especially during the campaign period, at least you need to abide by the laws itself, and we need to look at the reason why the law says so, because at least to ensure a level playing field. Because, yeah, if you see, for example, the candidate from the government side and the opposition side, as compared to independent candidate, you should you cannot guarantee for a level playing field. If you have more resources in terms of government money and so on, you can have Dewan Orang Ramai and so on, to put up a campaign for yourself, instead of, you know, independent candidate who have nothing to offer.
First, I want to ask you about the fact that this is a by-election at the state level, not the federal level, and some people, of course, are focused on the use of state government resources, but not federal government resources. How would you, you know, kind of alert us to the ways in which federal government resources could be used but not visible to, you know, kind of ordinary observers?
Yes, okay, first, when we talk about this caretaker government, of course, now, the current Selangor government and also a federal government is not a caretaker government, but at least we need to have certain guidelines that can be perceived, can be interpreted as certain policies for the caretaker government if there is a by-election. Even not only caretaker government by-election, but in fact, as of now, if the parliament itself is dissolved, we don't have any policies, legalized and to stipulate what should or should not be done by the caretaker government. We only rely just by convention, from the foreign countries, what the government should and should be done. So that's why, that's the reason why, moving forward, when we talk about the amendment of the Election Officers Act, what we are trying to put forward is a provision that what government should and should not do, especially during the campaign period, regardless of state elections or any by-election or the general election.
So Housing and Local Government Minister Ngah Kor Ming also unveiled a more than 5 million ringgit allocation for Hulu Selangor residents to be used for projects in Kuala Kubu Baru. He has, of course, denied that this was in view of the by-elections. How does Bursay view these kinds of funding?
Yes, for us, in our statement, we see that this announcement as a violation of the guidelines under the 3C prohibition. Actually, we said with 3C prohibition. First, no conditions. Second, no campaign. And also, no candidates. And actually, for us, it is unethical as well. Unethical practice. Because, announcement was made the announcement was made just merely because of the by-election. So it could be interpreted as a by-election campaign. And for us, it is unethical because still there is a campaign agenda. I mean, now's announcement. Even though it is for the benefit of for the whole voters in Kuala Kubu Baru. So for us, we urge the government to stop this unethical practice, which contradicts to the principle of fair political competition in elections.
Faisal, you know, many decades ago, one of the biggest concerns was fee media coverage and, you know, free and fair media coverage. How do you think, this plays out in Kuala Kubu Baru for its by-election? Do you think generally the media is free to report on all sides and nobody really has the upper hand?
Yeah, I think for that matter, we would like to suggest or we would like to propose an open debate for all candidates so that all candidates, regardless of from government or opposition or from another to from independent candidates, they will get equal media coverage, especially in terms of their manifesto, their policies and plan for KKB, and also their aspirations. I think at least if KKB can have an open debate, full coverage by the whole media, for example, it will lead the way for the next election for Sabah, Sarawak, and also it will be a good momentum for general elections.
So this is something that Sharad was talking about earlier, this question of government machinery and how it gets used. And activists often call for a level playing field. That's the phrase. So with regard to this particular by-election, but also more broadly, what more can be done to make the competition free and fair?
First, we need to have proper guidelines. At least what government should and should not do, especially during the campaign period of time. And basically, as I said before as well, we need to have more major amendments of the Election Officers Act. So at least it will cover certain things with regard to government, the use of government machineries. So it will be under the law and all parties will or should abide by this law. And for us, without having this more structural change, especially in terms of not only by discretionary of Menteri Besar or Prime Minister, but having it to be legalized, my concern, it will erode the confidence of the people, especially the voters, in the electoral system and democratic process in our country.
So, Faisal, we move away from the level playing field issue to the question of the conduct of the campaign. Are you concerned about mudslinging between candidates and parties, the use of race and religious sentiment, even sexism? I mean, from your point of view, should the relevant authorities be tough during this period, or should they give more latitude during an election campaign?
As of now, the only way I have of observing and observing action regards to the conduct of election campaign and also MAC. And there is no power given to the EC to take action. So at least for us, if we amend, for example, election officers, we can give certain power to election commission, for example, to if there is example election campaigns
Faisal, unfortunately, I think the line there was too rough. But thank you so much for speaking with us today. I don't think that we will, unfortunately, have the time to return to the call. But it is clear, I think, that there are concerns around ethics and that there will continue to be with not just by elections, but in general, right? Campaign periods, they're a time where we do see these sorts of grey areas emerge.
Yeah, and I think what Faisal said over and over again, which I think is very important, is the legislation has to keep up with the times. It needs to be refined for the realities of 21st century. As you say, it's an act that was, I think, passed in 1954.
Four. Yeah.
So, yes, a lot of time has passed, 70 years to be precise. Time for a bit of legislative innovation when it comes to this, to see the kind of elections we want to have conducted in Malaysia.
We've got a couple of messages in relation to stories that came up earlier in the day. One quite tender, and actually both really quite tender-hearted. Let's start with this one on the subject of men being victims of love scams and then potentially being too embarrassed to come forward and talk about it. Naomi says, I wonder if male victims are less likely to come forward because their love scams have more of a sexual element compared to the stereotypical lonely old ladies who fall in love. Personally, I know two men who were scammed after being blackmailed with sexual pics. Ned Schulman's documentary, Catfish, was so tender and heartbreaking, but I wonder if stories like his are few and far between.
Yeah, Naomi, I don't know if it's necessarily true that, you know, there's less sexual content in relationships, you know, where the victim is a woman than a man. But I would say that in any instance, that element does make the victim perhaps more fearful of reporting because they feel that maybe they have made or have transgressed.
Or they've just gotten themselves into compromising situations.
Yeah, and which allows them to be blackmailed.
Exactly. On the subject of today being World Dance Day, Anon says, not a good dancer, but dancing was my way to de-stress. More fun and less expensive than going to a shrink. Also, no social stigma in dancing. I think it also helped keep me physically fit because I can enjoy myself while burning all those calories. In fact, I look forward to the dancing section in my aerobics classes. Now in my 60s, I dance alone, occasionally in my own room so that I would not shock my daughter, but I do miss the weekly disco rituals of my younger days.
And on love your the sentiment that, I mean, dancing alone, I think, is a wonderful thing. It's so liberating. Actually, I wish there was dance, and I don't know if this is true, but I wish there was dance in schools. I think kids, you know, getting in touch with themselves and their bodies and learning to move, I think that is something that if you're liberated as a young person, you can carry on into old age.
Thank you, everybody, for getting in touch. So do keep it here, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.